Welcome to A Pod Too Far, the place for people who understand that everything you need to know about life can be learned from old war movies. Now, I don't really understand how modern things like podcasting work, but if you like this show, you should subscribe to it and review it and do things like that because that somehow helps the magic to happen. So please like and subscribe and leave us a five-star review. This week, I'm in the trenches of France, trying to save the podcast from an unjust death sentence. Yes, it's 1957's Stanley Kubrick classic, Paths of Glory. And joining me in the jail cell, convicted of crimes never really explained, is a whimpering social undesirable, Duncan Weldon.
Hello, Rob.
Hello. Had you seen this before?
I actually hadn't. I thought I had when you suggested it. No, I hadn't. So I
what
watched
did
it.
You think you'd seen?
Well, yeah. Well, I know. I was thinking of a different First World War movie. So I watched it for the first time, and it's a good film. It's very, very much a Stanley Kubrick movie.
Yeah, all the bits are there, including probably, I think, the first Kubrick film I saw may have been Full Metal Jacket, just because generationally that was the one that we all wanted to see. Yeah. And I've always thought he has a weird sort of sterility somehow to the way that he directs people. You just kind of feel like Stanley Kubrick wasn't completely comfortable with the humans. I mean, this is why I've never watched Eyes Wide Shut, because I just can't imagine that I would enjoy it. But yes, it that's there too. But actually, that sort of works.
It does. And it's right down to things like the use of silence.
Yeah,
I mean, Kubrick is tremendous at just using silence, which not many directors are, because, you know, you can get away with it more in a film than, say, in a podcast. But even in a film, you know, people are reluctant just to have those moments of silence, which he uses to great effect here.
They make people uncomfortable, but he doesn't mind.
Maybe
he was just uncomfortable all the time. He wanted other people to feel it too. Yeah, so he makes a B-movie called The Killing, which is a sort of a superior heist gone wrong film. And that goes sort of so well that people say, that's right, this man a blank check. He can, not a blank check, but he can do something.
A big check,
A big check. And he has read the Humphrey Cobb novel, Paths of Glory.
Which is mid-30s?
I think so, yes. Yeah, he read it as a teenager, so that would be about right. And it's been sort of on his mind. Yeah. And I think it had been turned into a play, not terribly. It's sort of, It's one of these things that has been, at this point, is regarded as a classic, but also not a tremendously commercial one.
Yeah.
And he has the idea to make it. He manages to get Kirk Douglas on board, which is the crucial thing, because at that point, the studio money comes in.
This is peak Kirk Douglas.
Yeah,
as well.
Kirk
so
Douglas
late
is
50s,
a proper star at this point, and can essentially. And I mean, I think a third of the budget for this film is his salary.
Yeah.
And it's a passion project. So he is simultaneously slumming it and taking all the money. I mean, this is not one that we watched on Sunday afternoons, I'm absolutely certain. But I think actually I saw it as a... Do you remember the Moviedrome strand that BBC Two used to have?
Yes.
10 o'clock on a Sunday night?
Yeah.
Where you watched a lot of great films in that.
I mean, this isn't your classic Sunday afternoon movie, it must be said. But
But we'll come to this. But the tracking shot of Kirk Douglas walking through the trenches.
Yes.
You see that in
you
lots
see
of other places.
That's
the bit of this that you will have recognised, even if you hadn't seen it.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, for those people who haven't seen it, it's the story of a French regiment in 1916, during World War One, which is ordered to take a target, and it fails, and the generals, after some negotiation, demand that three men be shot. Actually, pour encourager les autres. So, is this a war movie? Is this a courtroom drama? Or is this just a film about another bloody awful day in the office?
It's a bit of both, isn't it? I mean, I think it's primarily, I think it's more a courtroom drama than a war movie. And I think the really big set pieces, the big moments in the film happen in the court-martial.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some incredible
We will come to the big scene, but there are some incredible big scenes.
But I think more than that, though, it's a Kubrick. You mentioned Full Metal Jacket before, which is 30 years later. There are, in many ways, despite the vast differences in plot, a lot of similarities between these films. You know, they're fundamentally about war and the military as an institution, which can be a dehumanizing one, which can lead to some perverse outcomes. I mean, actually, there's a bit of that in Barry Lyndon as well. There's, you know, it's one of these threads throughout.
Well, and Dr. Strangelove, I found myself thinking of, which is the third option here. And I would just like to make the case that this is fundamentally an office film. Mm-hmm. This is not an original thought of mine, but Terry Gilliam, when he was making Brazil, said the thing that was in his head was Paths of Glory, because really it's just a film. It's a film about stupid bureaucracy.
Yes, yes.
And, well, why are we doing that? Well, because someone else says so, and I don't want to question him. Well, but it's obviously this is obviously a stupid thing to do. Well, nevertheless, we're going to do it.
Yeah, it's just, you know, when I've encountered that level of stupid bureaucracy in an office, it's usually been a dispute over whether you can fix the printer yourself or whether you need to call a service desk. It doesn't result in people being executed by firing squad. But yes, but yes,
but it is. Yeah, and again, there's a lot of that in Strangelove. Mm. You know, the sort of, you can't fight, this is a war room, but also, you know, just this kind of inevitability.
Yes.
This outcome that nobody seems to want is going to happen.
Because that's how the institution works. And the institution is tooled up to do one thing, and it creates all of these perverse outcomes along the way.
So the book that the film is based on a true story. Do you know the story of the, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, I'm sure, Souain Corporal's Affair?
I think your Souain Corporal's Affair is a better pronunciation than I would have gone for. Yeah, so this is, it's actually, I think the affair was 1915 rather than 16. It's a very similar, you know, you see exactly the inspiration. French regiment refuses to attack a position. There is a demand from higher command that examples are made.
So first of all, the other thing is there is a moment where the general demands that the troops be shelled in their own trenches.
Yes, be shelled by their own artillery, which
is refused without a written order, which is
Exactly. So I think in the French case, they ended up convicting about 24 people, I think, got convicted. They then commuted lots of the sentences. They ended up executing four of them.
Yeah.
And then a couple of hours after the execution, the sentences were commuted to hard labor. But it's a specific case. So First World War in general, you know, in not the American army or the Australian army, actually, but the British army, the French army, the German army, all shoot people for cowardice.
Yes. 306 British soldiers.
Yeah. And they're all shot. And, you know, nowadays we know lots of it was shell shock, all of this, you know, lots of pardons have been granted, but it was a thing that was happening in the First World War. What is interesting and different about this case, which is in the book, which is what the film is about, is it's about specifically almost randomly selecting people to make an example. It's not that someone has deserted in the face of the enemy.
Yes.
It's that the unit as a whole has failed. So you're almost going back to this, you know, ancient Roman idea of decimating a unit, you know, selecting one in 10 to make an example of. And that's why it's a particularly shocking case of this.
Yes, yes. I mean, so there, you're right. So 306 British soldiers were pardoned in 2006 after a necessarily very long campaign. And previous governments had, you know, this wasn't that this had suddenly come up. Yeah. Previous governments had just sort of stuck with the Ministry of Defence line, which was, we can't go around pardoning people after we've shot them.
Yeah.
You know, the things you have to disband the whole regiment, sort of thing. And in there are stories of shell shock. There's a man who'd used his rifle to block a trench, who is then shot for having given up his weapon. Mm. You know, it's just awful stuff.
Yeah.
The French, you know, how many people the French shot?
A lot more.
Twice as many, 600, 600 more. And they have a problem that they destroyed or lost a lot of the files. So one of their issues is, we can't just pardon everyone we shot, because some of the people we shot were murderers and rapists and spies and things, and actually we're reasonably content with the justice system of 1915 to have shot them. But I mean, this was just what everyone was doing. I mean, it's interesting when we were talking about Patton and the famous soldier slapping incident.
Yeah,
of course, Patton starts his career in World War One, so slightly explains where he's coming from.
Yeah.
Slapping a soldier for shell shock is mercy.
Yes.
I guess.
That's yes.
Pretty much not the view of anyone else, though. Let's go to the after-action report. So I mean, there are so many great scenes in this film, and all the scenes in this film are beautiful.
Beautifully lit, beautiful sound, beautifully shot.
What I love about the opening scene is so much detail, so much, and it uses this sort of use of focus so that the whole time that they're talking, you can see all the paintings behind them and all the little twiddly bits of you're in a really nice French chateau. Well, the one doesn't look so bad, does it?
Yeah.
There is this notion in Britain at the moment that the sort of the lions led by donkeys thing is all Blackadder's fault. Actually, you can see quite a lot of the Blackadder view of World War One in this film.
Lions led by donkeys, you know, it's an Alan Clark line. It's an Alan Clark line from Alan Clark's first history book, which he made up. I mean, he actually made it up.
This is Alan Clark. This is Alan Clark. Yeah, Alan Clark, the Tory MP, diarist.
No. So he attributes the quote to one of the German generals, I think Ludendorff. But, you know, eventually press, let me just create it, admits he made it up. So this very, very famous quote is an invention to sell books of Alan Clark's in, I think, the early 60s, late 50s. But, you know, but it encapsulates this idea that, yes, you know, generals are, like in Blackadder, you know, sitting around in quite nice French chateaus and asking their men to do the same thing again and again and again, and it's not working. And, yeah, there has been quite a big pushback against that in the historiography of the last 20, 30 years, that actually there was an awful lot of tactical innovation in trench warfare. They didn't keep doing the same thing. And, you know, by the end, you've got much more sophisticated use of artillery tactics. You've got tanks. You've got fire and movement tactics. And, you know, it's not just everyone stands up and walks slowly across no man's land towards the enemy.
Though there was a certain amount of that.
Oh, yeah, particularly at the start, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Basically, combat tactics haven't caught up with the fact that the existence of the high-powered rifle.
And the machine gun. And the First World War is different to anything that's happened. But, you know, the Franco-Prussian War in 1870, you know, only 40 years before, the big war between France and Germany, you know, the conventional period of that war is over in a few months. You know, the big wars of the 19th century in Europe have tended to last weeks or months. Everyone thinks it's going to be the same. And then suddenly you find yourself in a position when you've got all of these industrialized countries dug in against each other. You've got trench lines which stretch from the sea to the Swiss border. And when you've got a constant trench line which goes from one end to the other, you can't do what generals want to do, which is try and get around your opponent's sides, their flanks. So you're sort of stuck. And you end up in this horrible war of attrition, which lasts for years.
So we get all of that. We get this sense of tremendous luxury, and then we go to the trenches.
Yeah.
But in that opening scene, there's also this, and again, this is why I make the case for the office drama. The sort of the dynamics of the general saying, "Well, of it, you know, my men are far too important to me. I could never risk their life." Well, there's promotion in it for you. Ah, well, put it like that. And you just see, you know, you're allowed about 30 seconds of thinking, "Oh, well, this man doesn't seem so bad. He seems a good commander. He's saying the right things." Before it. Oh, I just think it's very well done.
Kubrick did his thing, and, you know, and sets up. Yeah, you're right. So there's an element of bureaucratic politics which runs throughout the film. And sort of mid to senior managers manoeuvring for position, damn the consequences for anyone else.
And by the time he's got to the trenches and to Kirk Douglas, we know what kind of man he is.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we get Kirk Douglas shirt off. You know, we're pretty clear what kind of man Colonel Dax is.
Yeah.
He's a man's man. But he's a man's man.
Well, he's Kirk Douglas, for God's sake. You don't get much more man's man in a 1950s context.
But as it will turn out, you know, he's not just a beefcake.
Yeah,
he's also France's leading lawyer.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, let's talk about the combat scenes. The recon mission.
Very, very
brilliant and effective and
tense and confusing at the same time.
And they don't bother to explain. You know, you find the guy blown up, and it's like, oh right, okay. Yeah. It doesn't patronize you. Yeah. The attack,
tremendously well done.
Is just that long sort of sideways tracking shot.
Yeah, yeah,
you see them going forward, and it It doesn't feel completely stupid that they're going forward, if you see what I mean. You feel like they might make it.
No, but this really is the Kubrick gift. That if you look at Full Metal Jacket, it's essentially two movies built together. But, you know, the first half is just, you know, a study in barracks life and indoctrination. Yeah. But then the second half has some tremendous sort of action, gritty combat scenes. And he's done the same here, where, you know, the courtroom scenes and the battle scenes both work incredibly well in their own ways. And it's quite weird to find them in the same film almost.
Meanwhile, the sort of the back in the trench, the order to shell his own men, Kirk Douglas is furious at discovering that somebody else hasn't gone forward. I mean, the other thing that this film does do is it makes a point that the general isn't completely wrong. There are men who are refusing to go forward.
Yes.
And
yes. I mean,
you're in an army and your job, you can't have soldiers refusing to go over the front just because they might get shot. It does offer that justification. And then suddenly, you know, we're back and we're having lunch again in this lovely chateau.
Yeah.
And there's this clever bit of negotiation because he gets them down from, you know, we should sort of shoot 40-odd men to, we'll settle for 3.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, I don't think we want officers to get involved in this. You know?
Yes.
Right, the trial. Because you say this is a courtroom drama, but this isn't A Few Good Men.
No. It's a very different, because, I mean, for a start, you know, the plot relies on this, this not being a trial. I mean, this being sort of, you know, an absolute travesty of procedure, you know, no time to read the charges, all of this sort of stuff. But, you know, it's all in that sort of fantastic plush interior. What I love about it is just the feel of those scenes is so far removed from the trench bits.
But the men belong in the trench, and you can see just they're just dazzled. Fundamentally, they don't understand what's happening to them.
Yes.
And they're completely out of place. And hang on, is this how everybody else's war is looking?
Yes.
Because Kubrick is at this stage a very young director.
Yeah.
And working with some very experienced actors, including the chap who's playing the French general, who I think after about 6 or 7 takes, or 16 or 17 takes, says, well, I think we've got it there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and Kubrick is, as was his way, saying, well, I think we could do one more.
Yeah.
And this actor blows up and says, I know what I'm doing, and we've got it. And Kubrick just sits and waits. And when he sort of vented all this, he says, right, well, I think one more.
Not a people person in some ways.
Not a people person, no. How do you feel about the jail scene? I can see your face.
Go on.
Yeah, well, I know that's how I kind of feel about it as well.
For me, this is the court scenes. This is the action scenes.
Yeah.
Well,
the march to the execution.
Yes.
Which goes on, again, use of sound, that goes on uncomfortably long.
Yes.
I mean, my wife was in the room for that bit. Yeah. And after a bit of drumming and marching and drumming and marching, she said, how long is this going on? this is sort of longer than you think.
Yes.
I suppose if they were the last minute of your life, you'd want it to go on. But so you get the execution, March 8th. All of the execution is brilliant. And there's we've had this, the evening scenes with Colonel Dax with Kirk Douglas, where he goes and tries to sort of bargain for his men's lives, and then essentially realizing he's failed, he puts the weak, cowardly lieutenant on the firing squad. I love that scene.
Yes.
I couldn't even tell you why it's so great. It's just sort of just a moment of, you think, oh, well, finally we've got a moment of justice in this. Somebody is going to have to deal with the consequences of his own actions.
Yes.
And
all the way back to the recon mission at the beginning. You know, it's taken, you know, there's a lot that happens in between these moments.
And then we get two final scenes. One is the final scene where the general realizes he's being hung out to dry by his superior, which is quite emotionally satisfying.
Yes.
But the really amazing final scene, and the one that I before we rewatched this, I probably hadn't seen it for 20 years before we rewatched it, but I could have told you about the final scene.
Yeah.
Which is the men in the, what is it, hostelry, bar of some sort, and the German captain
singer. Singing, yes.
Where you get you get these men are monsters.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, you know, and they're all, and you get their sort of their eyes looking at this yeah. German woman, and you think, nah, this isn't going to go very well.
Yeah.
You know, and then she starts singing and they recognize the song and they start singing and yeah. suddenly they're back from being monsters, husbands and fathers and brothers. Yes. And, oh.
Yeah, no, yeah. Again, it's the sound. It's the use of sound throughout the film is what really, really makes it. It's one of those, what, yeah. I mean, which I think is the one of the defining Kubrick characteristics. The sound is just perfect.
And she is, I think, the only German that we see in this film. Because I don't think we see the people who are shooting at the...
No, I don't think we do.
I mean, maybe there's a shot of a guy with a machine gun, but I don't...
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure there is. You're quite right.
This is a Kubrick thing yeah. where really the people we're at war with are ourselves. Yeah, sort of. Yeah, I mean, that's a platoon thing as well. Yeah. But yeah, the French can provide both the goodies and the baddies,
yes.
as it
yes.
turns out. That's so she is also, I think, the one woman in the film.
Yes, and didn't she marry?
Yes, yes. And Kubrick at this point is going through. I don't know if he's actually getting divorced at this point, but he's certainly getting divorced fairly shortly after yeah. this point. And he marries her. I'm just trying to find her name. Is it Christiane Kubrick? But she was credited in this as Suzanne Christian. Yeah, I mean, there's a Roger Ebert anecdote about going to see her after Kubrick had died and her taking him to see the grave and him standing there and wanting to say to her how good she'd been in this scene and just thinking no other people have said it so I know it would be facile, but I mean she is really good in this. I don't think that she had much else of a film career, to be honest. Eyes Wide Shut, she's Woman Sitting. No, there's
it doesn't sound like a big yeah. role, does it? It's a long time since I've seen that film, but
no idea what the movie Body Count is. Haven't been able to find that.
That matter.
The Kula King Award for the most gratuitous American character. Now, there are obviously no American characters in this, except that they've just done the French army in American accents.
Yes.
What is your feeling about that?
See, I think that's fine. I really do. So I think, how else are we going to do this? You could do this film in French with subtitles,
mm-hmm.
Which would be one option.
You can't have Kirk Douglas, I think, at that point.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, so it limits who you can cast. Or you do it in English. And if you're doing it in English, then I think, you know, getting everyone, you know, if this film had been done with everyone adopting an allo allo style French accent, you know, stick with me, I don't think it would have worked.
These men are innocent.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
So, yeah, so I think it's perfectly fine to do a, you know,
yeah.
You know, in the same way that I'm comfortable with Gladiator not being in Latin.
Yes. I mean, some critics couldn't get their heads around it. And I do think there is something odd, because I think the first time I saw it, I didn't immediately realize that they were the French army and, you know, and they've got American accents. So you sort of assume that they're Americans. Mm. And there is something odd about seeing Kirk Douglas in what is recognizably not an American uniform.
Yes.
I agree with you. The other way to do this, the other trope, and I can't remember which film it's in. I was trying to think the other day, is people start off speaking German and then the camera moves in on something and moves out. And now they're all speaking English.
Yeah. Again, I just think it's fine. It's fine to have, you know, to cast Americans in a film about the French. What I think is a more interesting decision is, obviously it's because he liked the book, you know, from his teenage years, but why he was so interested in making a film about the French army in the First World War. In that, you know, there's this sort of streak of sort of anti-war, anti-militarism, at least, in Kubrick's filmmaking. But by the end of his career, it's very targeted at the American military.
I think it's interesting, him and war, because he is obviously, you would say, an anti-war filmmaker. But on the other hand, he does make a lot of films about war, and they are quite good.
Yes.
And the bits that, like the attack in this, they are directed by somebody who can, in a sense, feel. He can feel why a war movie would be why people enjoy war movies and enjoy watching it and so on. It's not. He's not somebody who hates war in a kind of, oh, I just can't see the appeal of it kind of way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I think he understands the visceral nature of it, the
because,
men
I mean,
being
that's the
tested.
Interesting, yeah, because it's in this film, it's in his other films as well, that you're right, there's two elements to it. There's the sort of the human element of, oh, isn't this terrible, and, you know, using the military as an institution, which forces people into certain paths, which they're not all suited to. You know, very common in this film, very common in most other films. But yeah, there's also the, you know, here's an excuse to make a really well-shot action sequence.
Yeah.
Which is not glorifying war, but is entertaining. I don't know how to...
It stirs something in you. Yeah. And I mean, the Full Metal Jacket sort of closing...
Yeah, yeah.
Long sort of... scenes are amazing and really good. And again, you know, I mean, the sort of they work on the surface level as well as the sort of the subtextual, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of the best death, I think it's a three-way tie.
It is. less debate on this one than any other film we've done in some ways.
In terms of the best meme, I mean, I wouldn't mind. I bet I could find a Kirk Douglas walking to work. You could use that on a Monday morning. So the stiffest upper lip. One of the three men has a stiff upper lip.
Yes.
One of them is unconscious.
Yeah.
One of them. The actor's name is Timothy Carey. Mm-hmm. I think it's Turkle. One goes on to be a Kubrick standby. You see him, he's the barman in The Shining and that kind of thing.
Okay.
And Timothy Carey, who's quite a well-known actor, who had been, I think, pretty sure he's in The Killing, was such a nightmare on the set, including at one point faking his own kidnapping in the course of making this film.
To get out of a day's shooting,
he just for publicity. He's quite an odd man.
Yes, yes.
And he's the one who's wailing all the way to the firing post.
Yeah.
And the moment that they had shot the final scene for which they needed him in close up, Kubrick fires. No, we can do the rest. We can do the rest without you. We'll shoot it from behind. No, just get off. On the other hand, he is. That scene where he's moaning and crying and so on, again, it just goes on too long and you really like him to stop and man up, you know, but why should he?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. There are obviously no nasty Nazis. There are some foul Frenchmen and some awful officers.
Yeah.
Which of the two generals is actually worse?
Oh, no. Okay. I think actually the more senior general is actually the worst.
Yes.
You know, because he sort of reveals himself when he thinks that, you know, when the other one gets his sort of comeuppance, you know, the artillery orders to fire men, all of this, and he presumes this was just manoeuvring to get the job.
Yeah.
And sort of reveals himself as, you know, an awful character.
Yes. I mean, it's a close run thing.
Yeah.
But I think, I agree. I think that, because in a sense, I think if you think this is office politics, this stuff does come from the top.
Yes.
And the junior general is. He's really doing what his boss wants.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly it.
The Dambusters dog prize for the most problematic moment. I mean, I don't think anything's problematic.
That's Rob's endorsement there, listeners, making an example of shooting.
I do think, I don't think this is problematic, but the final scene does an amazing job of showing that these men could be complete monsters.
Yes.
That scene could so easily go another way.
Yeah. And the tension is there when you're watching it.
Yeah, but I think that's deliberate. I think that's who he wants you to know, that these men have been. I mean, that's, again, the Full Metal Jacket thing. You make these men into killers, you have to dehumanize them.
Yeah.
In terms of Loose Lips, I mean, I like the moment where the only good bit, I think, in the jail scene is when one of the men is complaining that that cockroach is going to live longer than me, and the other one kills it. Yeah. Now you've got the edge on it.
Some of the court speeches are very good.
Yes.
Shame to be a member of the human race, all of this sort of stuff. Yes. I mean, it's, you know.
And I like the general line after the execution. This one had a sort of splendor to it, don't you think? The men died wonderfully. There are, sadly, no completely implausible moments in this film.
No. I mean, obviously, you know, inspired by the novel, inspired by the events, but it's all a plausible.
Yeah.
Plausible scenario.
It's all there. Judgment at Nuremberg. Is any of this a war crime? None of this is a... I mean, were war crimes actually even a thing in 1915, 1916?
Yeah, you've got a Geneva Convention. You've got the Hague Convention on War. Yeah. You get use of poison gas and all of that. So there's not a great deal of respect for for those rules. But no, I mean, internal, you know, it's a weird thing, isn't it? I think you can sort of do whatever you want to your own men. If you were to do this to prisoners of war.
Right, you can't do this to the Germans.
Yeah, you can't be like, you know, we're going to pick randomly three of you and shoot you.
No, that's definitely
a distinct war crime, but, you know.
Right.
Yeah, you want to shoot three of your own guys, yeah, knock yourself out. I mean, there's no...
So, I mean, sometimes, Duncan, I worry that war doesn't make much sense. So, not a lot of people know this. Do you know about the ending that Kubrick wanted?
No.
So Kirk Douglas is essentially the champion of this film.
Yeah.
Once he's on board, it's getting made. They go through various scripts. They're shooting out in Germany. He gets out to Germany. I don't know quite why they're shooting out in Germany with a bunch of American actors, but they are. Maybe
I think they wanted the extras, apparently.
Right.
Yes. Lots of, like, you know, find a lot of German extras who sort of know what they're doing.
Drill. Yeah.
Relatively cheap. But yeah. Whereas if you'd filmed in France, you'd have had... Anyway, yeah.
Well, we'll come to France.
Yeah.
Kirk Douglas gets out there and he gets the new script and Kubrick has written a happy ending in.
How's he done this?
I think it's that at the last minute at the firing post, the senior general rocks up and says, no. I mean,
if you'd had that really long, drawn-out scene then, fooled you.
Yes, this would have been terrible. This is the point that Kirk Douglas makes.
Yeah.
and it's quite... The account of the conversation is essentially that Kubrick said, well, I worry that this will... You know, the people won't like this ending. And Kirk Douglas said, you have to... This is the film. This is why I've come to make this film.
Yeah.
And Kubrick says, but...
James Cameron Kubrick, making Titanic, saying, well, what if it doesn't sink?
Bear with me. But Kubrick's very specific anxiety is, essentially, he's a very young director at the start of his career. What if they don't let me make any more films?
Yeah.
And you can understand that. But Kirk Douglas says, I'm not going to let you make this film. So the original ending is restored.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. You mentioned not filming in France. You also couldn't see this film in France.
Really?
For decades.
Really?
Yeah. Not a popular film with the French military. It also apparently wasn't shown on American bases. Certainly until the 70s you couldn't see it in France because it was too sensitive and perceived as being anti-French.
I can partially see where that attitude comes from, in that here you've got a film which is entirely about the French military being this sort of bureaucratic, monstrous horror show filled with American actors speaking in American accents.
With an American director and American money.
And I can see why you might be like, oh, come on.
Yes, let us make cultural appropriation, I think we call it now.
Yes,
but actually, that's the Dan Busters Dog Award. That's take it all back. Dan Busters Dog Award, it is cultural appropriation of French military murders. Yeah. Right. Duncan, is this the operation that changed the course of World War II?
No, it's not. But I bet it is within the World War I context. I mean, you've got the corporals of the fair, which obviously not changed the course of the war, but you do get, you know, major, you know, we don't tend to think about much sort of the sort of Anglophone historiography, but you get some massive French military mutinies. Around 1916, 17, like really, really quite seriously, sort of Western Front in peril. But, you know, after, Verdun is this just absolutely horrific bloodbath, sort of like the Somme on speed for the French army. And towards the end of it, you get whole regiments saying, we're not having any more of it. Very threatening. So, yeah, the fact the French army fend itself, taking these really quite extreme measures makes slightly more sense in the context.
I mean, there is a thing that over the course of the 20th century, governments worked out how to turn men into killers.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, the statistic I always struck by is what proportion of American soldiers fired their weapons during World War II.
It's very low, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's actually why you get the Full Metal Jacket.
Yes.
First half is that by the after that they think, right, well, we need to train men who will pull the trigger.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we need to turn them into monsters.
Yeah.
And yes, obviously none of that has been figured out in World War One.
Yeah.
In this war that in lots of ways somehow seems to be more monstrous than all of them, because there's no maneuver. Worth dying for.
It's a very good film. I'm really pleased I saw it. It's a very good film. I will watch it again, not soon. The acting is good. The cinematography is fantastic, and just a great example of just very good storytelling.
Let me give you Kirk Douglas's view on this. This is him speaking in 1969. He's made 50 pictures at this point, and he's talking about his career, and he's talking about Paths of Glory. There's a picture that will always be good. Years from now. I don't have to wait 50 years to know that. I know it now. Certain pictures have a universality of theme. That's Paths of Glory. Paths of Glory, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for listening. Next week, we're heading to the jungle with Merrill's Marauders.